Last time we talked about nail order, and let me just remind you of the main point that we did the spin wave theory, and within the linear order spin wave theory, what we basically do is map the deviations from the classical state into bosons. So high boson density corresponds to low order, right? And then we found, if we solve these sums or make them into integrals and just put them in mathematics or something like that, that in the two-dimensional case, the sublattice magnetization is reduced by about 40% from the classical order, which means that the boson density per site is something like 0.2, because the maximal order is one half, for spin one half. And again, this turns out to be, as we will see later when we do numerics, that this is actually quite a good approximation, but you should not always expect it to be a good approximation. But the point of this was also to point out that this kind of order, the nail order, it's basically a classical kind of order, right? I mean, if you we start with something which is the exact ground state in the classical system, which corresponds to S goes to infinity here. And then when we add the quantum fluctuations, we just reduce that type of order. We introduce some fluctuations, but it's still quite close to a classical state. So now we will talk about non-magnetic states, which are much more quantum mechanical. So they really don't even have any good classical analogs. Maybe one could cook up something, but at least I'm not aware of any really good analog. So let's look at let's look at just two spins again, the simplest case we can imagine. And so I want to discuss the quantum fluctuations from a different perspective. Instead of starting with the classical state and see how the fluctuations are reduced, I want to start from the most quantum mechanical situation we can imagine. So if you have just two spins and they interact with this Heisenberg interaction, so J is positive, it's an antiferromagnet, then we know that the ground state is the singlet. So this is the exact ground state for two spins, of course. Now, the energy of that is minus 3J over 4. Okay, now let's compare this state with the nail state. So if you just consider the nail states of two spins, they are the up-down and down-up, and no fluctuations. So these are the maximally ordered nail states for two spins. Now, these are, of course, not eigenstates of this Hamiltonian, right? The eigenstates are the singlets and triplets, and we know that even without doing any calculation, because this interaction has a rotational symmetry, so the eigenstates must be classified by spin, and the spin can be 0 and 1 for two spins. These are not eigenstates of the total spin. So we can compute the expectation value of the energy. And now you see here that the expectation value of the energy is minus J over 4, whereas the exact energy of this one is minus 3 J over 4. So the energy is 3 times lower here. The magnitude is 3 times higher. So even though this contains these nail components, but it's a particular linear combination of them, so that those fluctuations reduce the energy by a huge amount, right? And it's clear why, because of the rotational invariance. This is just one component, so if we just look at the Hamiltonian, this is why we get J over 4. But the Hamiltonian has three components, the Z, X, Y, and Z, and this is the X and Y. And because it's rotationally invariant, all the components have to have the same energy, so this is just a third of the total. Okay, this is very simple, but the point is here that the quantum fluctuations here, and here they are maximal, really help to lower the energy. Yes?
Same result if we consider, say, the other model like XY model and IC model?
Good points. Of course, in the icing model, this would be the exact energy, and there would be no fluctuations. If we do the XY model, let's see, you know, what is the ground state of the XY model? It would probably be also something like that. So for two spins, yeah, I think in the icing model, there are no fluctuations, and this would still apply for the XY model. When we go to higher number of spins, we have to be a little careful because the XY model, of course, does not satisfy the complete rotational invariance with the three vectors. The eigenstates are not really classified by total spin. So let's not get too much into that. But here, I really have the Heisenberg model in mind. So later on, well, we actually will not even discuss X, Y models so much. But many, many issues are, of course, very similar. Okay. Well, another point I wanted to make was that these Nell states are product states. So you must have encountered this notation before, this terminology. So this state, we write it like that one, the I spin is up, the J is down, and we can write it in this notation, but we can also write it as a product of the up and down, like this. Whereas this kind of state, the singlet, we cannot write as a product. We cannot find any single spin state times another single spin state which would give that state. So this is a highly entangled state. So in fact, the singlet is one of the maximally entangled states. So those of you who are interested in quantum information theory for sure know more about this than I do. So this maximally entangled state in some sense is as far as you can get from a product state. So product states basically have no entanglement, and this has maximal entanglement. So in that sense we can say that entanglement also leads to a better energy. Right? So when you go towards a product state, you increase the energy and you lose entanglement. So now let's see if we can say something for a larger number of spins. Of course, in the end, we are interested in going to infinite n. So one can, at least loosely speaking, say that even in a multi-spin system, the spins tend to entangle with each other because that lowers the energy. Right, so we expect some kind of entanglement, but if we look at the system in terms of pairs of spins, we know that one spin can only form a singlet together with one other of its neighbors. So let's say we have nearest neighbor interactions in 2D, we have four neighbors. We cannot form this maximally entangled configuration of a spin with more than one of its neighbors at a time. So that will lead to the energy being higher than this minus 3 over 4 per interacting bond, because we cannot always maximize or minimize the energy for each bond. So in fact, what one can think of is a basis, and one can even formalize this, and we will do it later, where the spins are in some superposition of singlet tilings of the lattice. So they are in what's called resonating valence bond states. Well, let's get back to that term later, because sometimes people use it in different contexts. But you can think of singlets. Actually, why don't I show this picture? So this is one example where this red bond here refers to a singlet like that. So if we look at one spin here, in this configuration, it forms the a singlet here. But of course, it's as likely to form the singlet with any of its neighbors. So this would not be an exact eigenstate of the system. But if we allow all possible coverings of these singlets, then we can actually write any total spin zero state in terms of these singlet coverings. We will do this more formally later. So now, since if we look again at these two spins, now in this configuration, they are these two are maximally entangled, but then we know that we have to have fluctuations. So in other configurations, the singlet is somewhere else, and then those two spins are less entangled. So when we have more than two spins, the entanglement is reduced relative to what it is in this two-spin case, which in some sense means that we have to get closer to a product state, because the maximally entangled state was as far as we can. Well, of course, we can form some maximally entangled state of many spins as well, but that will be some state which is would be very unlikely in such a configuration. But the point here is that if we consider non-magnetic states, it's actually often useful to look at them in this kind of picture or this kind of basis, instead of looking at the up and down spins, which can fluctuate as we do when we look at the nail state. When we look at magnetic states, it's often useful to use this basis of what we call valence bonds, which are these singlets. And then we can have different situations here. So here, by the way, I drew these singlets only between nearest neighbor spins, but as we will see later, I guess in the last week of the course, we really should include also longer bonds. So we are not restricted to just pairing up the neighbors. We can pair up any spins. Okay, so then we have these two main classifications of states when we look at them in this basis. We can have basically a disordered so-called resonating valence bond state, where you don't see any ordering in these singlets. It's just the soup of these singlets that fluctuate around. So that's also called the spin liquid. Then on the other hand, it can happen, and we will also see examples of this, that if you look at these valence bonds, you see some kind of ordering in them. So this would be an example of a valence bond solid. This would be a columnar valence bond solid. And this is just supposed to represent some typical configurations of the system. So there would be normally fluctuations here as well. So you would have other configurations where this order has been partially ruined. But if you look at expectation values, for example, of the probability of having a singlet here might be larger than the probability of having a singlet there. So the symmetry has been broken. So even if the Hamiltonian of the system is translationally invariant, one can actually spontaneously break the symmetry and form this kind of state. Now, I should also point out that even the Nell state itself we can look at in this basis. So if we take the ground state of the Heisenberg model, the spin 1/2 Heisenberg model, and we go to very large systems, we know that it should start to show this Nell order, which we got in spin wave theory, and we will look at it in other ways as well. And one can express that in these bonds too, but then it becomes really important to have long bonds. So again, we will discuss it in more detail later, but basically the Nell state can be expressed as a linear superposition of configurations like this, but you have to have a certain amount of long bonds. Whereas if you have only short bonds, at least in two dimensions, it would be really a non-magnetic state. Okay. Let me now... this was just a preview of the picture we later will use to look at non-magnetic states. Now let's look at some, well, one important theorem in quantum magnetism, which put some important conditions on magnetic order, such as Nell order. So the so-called Mermin-Wagner theorem, which states that if you have a Hamiltonian and it has some continuous symmetry, for example, like the XY or Heisenberg model, in 2D you cannot break a continuous symmetry at any temperature larger than zero. And in a 1D, here it should actually say in a 1D quantum system, in a 1D quantum system, you can also not break that symmetry even at zero temperature. And this is basically comes from the same theorem. So this, the original paper, Murmin-Wagner paper, dealt with two-dimensional classical systems, but one can map 1D quantum systems onto 2D classical systems, and if you, even if you consider 1D quantum at zero temperature, it maps to a 2D system at finite temperature. So the same theorem then tells us something about the quantum systems. Okay, so if we just look specifically at the Heisenberg model, it has a continuous symmetry. So in the case of these quantum spins, particular spin 1/2, which we are most interested in, the Hamiltonian has spin rotation invariance, which is really the SU2 rotation, with the spins we are looking at are SU2 spins. So that means that in these models, at finite temperature, we cannot have null order. And in 1D, we cannot have null order even in the ground state. So in two dimensions, we can have null order in the ground state, but not at finite temperature. So what this implies is if we look at spin correlations, so you know spin correlations are very useful tools for detecting and characterizing order and absence of order. So if we look at the spin correlation function in a two-dimensional Heisenberg model, it has this staggered factor. So Rij is the distance on the lattice between the two spins. It should really be vector Rij. So we have this staggered factor just coming from the fact that if we have an antiferromagnet on the square lattice, the correlations are always antiferromagnetic. As we go to zero temperature, of course, we get this null checkerboard state. So that's just taking care of that. And then the correlations decay exponentially with distance, at long distances. But this correlation length diverges as the temperature goes to zero. So that's how we can have order at zero temperature. The correlation length just becomes infinite. And it actually grows very fast. It grows exponentially fast. So even if the temperature is just, let's say, a tenth of J or something like that, the correlation length is already enormous. And for practical purpose, it may even look like it's complete long-range order. Okay, how about the 1D chain? Now it turns out that there's a difference. It depends on what the spin is. So in the case of the 2D Heisenberg model, this applies for any spin, spin 1/2, spin 1, and so on. For the chains with just nearest neighbor interactions, let's first consider the case of half-odd integer spin. So there it turns out that, okay, we cannot have long-range order. Instead, what we get in that case is that the correlations decay essentially as 1 over r. Again, this is that staggered factor. And there's a logarithmic correction to it. So this system is critical. So it's on the verge of ordering. There are perturbations one can add to it which immediately will order it at zero temperature. For example, if you make this interaction instead of S dot S, if you make it slightly anisotropic, so make it more icing-like, then immediately it's no longer SU2 symmetric, and immediately it becomes long-range ordered instead of critical. So in a sense, these chains correspond to critical points. Yep. Say again? Oh, so R0 is just some number. So it's just there because in the log we have to have something dimensionless. So we will actually, when we look at quantum Monte Carlo simulation, we will actually extract these numbers. we can look at simulations. So the theory, this is based on actually field theory, a continuum field theory describing the low energy physics of this chain. So this is a prediction from field theory, and numerical simulations have confirmed it, and in principle one can extract the number. So this number is not universal. If you take a chain you change it a little bit but still maintain the SU2 symmetry, then this is something that can change. Whereas the power here, 1 over r, will remain unchanged, and the log 1/2 will also still be there. So this is just listing some results now, and later on we will see examples of all these things. Okay, now if we have integer spin here, s equals 1 and 2, there was a conjecture by Haldane, so this was already in the mid-80s, where again using field theoretical formulations, Haldane found that there was a topological term in the field theory which was somehow important for these half-odd integer spins, but not for odd integer spins. So he predicted that in this case the system should not be critical, so it should have exponential decay of the correlations, and that has also been confirmed in calculations. And here the correlation length diverges as the spin goes to infinity. So when we go to infinite spin, it should become classical, and again we should have a long-range order. If we also look at these correlations for higher spin here, of course they should also go to the same classical limit, and in fact this is really the long distance behavior, and the behavior at short distances can be different, and eventually if you look at some up to some distance you will not even see any difference between these two cases when the spin becomes large. Okay, so we will not really look much at this Haldane chains, but we will look at these ladder systems, and it turns out that there's something similar there. So if we take a spin ladder with two or more legs, if we take three legs in the ladder like here, I don't know if you all can see this, it's just showing the ladder with three coupled chains, that behaves asymptotically for large distances like the single chain. Whereas if you have an even number of chains, it's more like this Haldane case that the spin correlations decay exponentially. And there are some really interesting crossover effects here. If we imagine that we want to look at the two-dimensional case as the limit of ladders with many chains, then depending on the ratio of the width to the length of the chain and so on, we will have different behaviors of the correlations. Yep.
What keeps you from getting a state that's like highly ordered, but where you don't know in which direction it's pointing, like everything's rotated by the global phase?
Right. So that's related to also what we discussed yesterday. I mean, the symmetry breaking feature of it. So if you have order of this kind, which would be null order, then you are right, for a finite system, that vector in spin space is not locked. In fact, it fluctuates. But the fluctuations, if you would be able to prepare a real system like that, and you would prepare it, let's say, with the vector pointing up, and then you just let it time evolve with the Hamiltonian, you would find that it evolves very slowly if the chain is large. So if the chain, or if the, let's say, the 2D lattice is where it would apply, if the lattice is small, you would find that it fluctuates around a lot, and as it becomes larger, it becomes slower and slower. So eventually, when it goes to infinite, it would not move. Right. So you would have all these local fluctuations in the order, but when you average those over the whole big system, the global order will not fluctuate when the system goes to infinity. We will actually, maybe on Friday, I will show this related issue of the Ising model. I mean, how you really can see explicitly this thing in the Ising model, where, of course, you don't have the vectors, you have just two directions, but it's pretty much the same. So I hope it will be clear. Okay, now let me start to talk a little bit about quantum phase transition. So we have discussed now a couple of cases of magnetically ordered state, the Nell state, and also I mentioned these magnetically disordered state, the spin liquid, RVB spin liquid, and the valence bond solid. So now I want to talk about quantum phase transitions between different kinds of states and in what kind of models we may be able to look at those phase transitions and what some of their characteristics are. And again, we will, when we start to do computations, we will talk about how to do the computation, and then we will also discuss this kind of physics in light of the experiment, the computational results that we obtain. So one case which is quite well studied, but still it's actually there are some interesting issues remaining here, and people are still studying these systems, are dimerized spin one-half systems. So by dimerized, I mean that there are two different coupling strengths. One we can think of as strong, and the other one weak, and I draw them with red and blue here. So this is a bilayer system where we have two square lattices, and they are coupled to each other by these stronger couplings. So we have these spin one-half spins again everywhere, and we have nearest neighbor Heisenberg interactions. In this case, I have a single layer, but I have arranged strong and weak couplings in such a way, in both cases this applies, that each spin belongs to one strong coupling. So then it's easy to see what happens in the limit when let's say the weak interaction is zero, or yeah, so if the weak interaction is zero, that corresponds to the ratio becoming very large. So when these, which are the ones that we can refer to as dimers, the strongly coupled pairs, in isolation, we already discussed the fact that they would be, the ground state is a singlet, and now we just have a bunch of non-interacting singlets. So for large G, we expect that the ground state should be a singlet product. So that should be exact in the limit of G goes to infinity. And for finite but still large G, we should have essentially this kind of singlet product state, but with some fluctuations on top of each other. So, well, when G is 1, we know in this case it's just the single layer Heisenberg model, so we know that we have Nell order. In that case, when J2 is 0, we have two completely independent planes. They also are Nell ordered, and it turns out that you have Nell order also if J2 equals J1 there. So we have something like this. We have a Nell state for sure on one end here. On this other hand, we have a singlet product state, which is a non-magnetic state. If you just have a bunch of singlets, and you compute some spin correlation, you will find that the spin correlation between spins in different dimers is zero. That's quite natural, of course. So then the question is, well, what happens now if we really have the singlet product state for infinite G, and then we make J1, we turn up J1, so we start to get fluctuations from in this state. Do we immediately get some Nell order or not? And it turns out we don't. So there are two distinct phases here, one which is of this dimer or singlet product type, but with fluctuations, and one which is the Nell state. So in the Nell state, we have a sublattice magnetization, and it turns out that the sublattice magnetization vanishes continuously, and at that point, if we go on, a gap opens in the excitation spectrum. So the spin waves are, of course, gapless. So the Nell state has gapless spin excitations. But on this side, there's a gap for all excitations, and that's the delta, and it opens continuously. Now, what happens if you look at the correlation lengths? I already mentioned that in the Nell situation, at finite temperature, we don't, strictly speaking, have order, but we have a correlation length which diverges as the temperature goes to zero, and it diverges actually exponentially. So this is the case here in this for these couplings. On the other hand, in this coupling, we expect the correlation length always to be finite, and in fact, the correlation is proportional to the inverse of the gap. And at the critical point, it turns out the correlation length goes like 1 over T, 1 over the temperature. So this is an important aspect of two-dimensional quantum spin systems, and again, we will look at it later. So one question is then, what is the nature of this quantum critical point here, which occurs at zero temperature as a function of this parameter? So it was shown by Haldane already some time ago in the 80s that 2D quantum spins map in terms of their long distance, low energy physics, they map onto 2 plus 1 dimensional classical Heisenberg spins. So if we start from the spin 1 half Heisenberg model and we form some coherent states, so we go to a basis of coherent spin states, we can write down an effective field theory in terms of those, and in the end, well, that's referred to as the nonlinear sigma model, and that should have the same properties as a classical Heisenberg model. So the prediction was that this phase transition here should be in the same universality class as the classical 3D Heisenberg model with vector spins. Yes?
The third one is, how do you separate the strong interaction as a single of strong interaction, like the last visual note?
You mean here?
No. That bond, the strong bond, is equal to the blue red minus red blue.
Let's see. I'm not sure. You mean this one? Yeah. So this just refers to the fact that we discussed before that the ground state of an isolated pair of spins, antiferromagnetically coupled, is a singlet. So this refers to the singlet. So this refers to a singlet product.
Then what I'm asking is, why are you putting blue? Is it because it couples to blue?
Okay. So here, the blue means that they are weakly coupled to each other, right? So if they are not coupled at all, if I completely erase these interactions, then they are completely isolated singlets, right? And then if I turn up this J1, these singlets or these dimers are no longer completely independent, so then the ground state is not going to be exactly a product of singlets anymore. It's going to have some fluctuations. But still, so you can think of this as a cartoon picture of the ground state. So this is also a cartoon picture of the nail state, right? Because we already have seen that the nail state is not just spin up, down, there are fluctuations in it. So, but this is somehow the cartoon picture which we can use in our mind to try to understand what kind of state it is. So this is the same. So in reality, what it means is that if you would compute or measure the singlet probability, the probability of having a singlet on these bonds, it would be large on these bonds and small on the other bonds. So, and as we come to the critical point, the difference would become smaller and smaller. The probability of having the singlet here and here would become almost the same, and they would become exactly the same. Well, actually, that is not completely true, because in this case, we have manual dimerization, so it's actually, what I just said was not true. It's true in some other models we will discuss later. But when the singlets start to couple, at some point, nail order can again start to form. But the point is that happens at a specific critical value. It's not like we induce a little bit of nail order immediately when we couple them. We don't do that. Instead, we induce some correlations between the spins, and that correlation length grows as we come here, and here it diverges. All right. this will become clearer, I think, later when we look at an example. Okay, now let me talk about a phase transition in a spin chain. So this is one of the most well-studied also examples of quantum phase transitions. So here we have a chain, and again you see I use red and blue here. So red refers to nearest neighbor interactions, and blue refers to second nearest neighbor interactions. That I draw it in two different ways here, but it's completely equivalent. So there are actually some materials which have this kind of structure where we have interactions. Well, maybe it's, let's see, how did I, yeah, it's like that. So you can see that these are actually equivalent. And now again, it turns out that as a function of this coupling ratio, we have different kinds of ground states of this chain. And again, I'm considering the case where both these couplings are positive, so they are both antiferromagnetic. If one of them is ferromagnetic, you can have even other things that I will not discuss here. So we already discussed the fact that the chain with just J1 couplings, just the normal Heisenberg chain, has this kind of spin correlations. And that turns out to be the case even when we have this J2 coupling if it's not very strong. So if it's less than something like 0.24, then the correlations still look like this. So it's still in some sort of critical state. Now, that chain with J2 equals 0 actually has an exact solution that, as you may know, it was written down by Hans Bethe already in 1931 and worked out in more detail later, and the solution is actually quite complicated. So from the solution one can get things like the ground state energy and also some energies of excitations. But to explicitly compute things like the correlation function, people have actually managed to do that only lately in the past. Well, progress has been made continuously, but in the past 10 years or so, people have been able to numerically use this so-called Bethe ansatz to compute correlations. But this result was actually first obtained based on a field theory. So many of the results, even though it has an exact solution, many results come from these field theories that have been proposed to describe the low energy physics. Okay, so that field theory applies, or this result of the field theory applies up to some value of this coupling. So we should also point out that, okay, we have discussed spin waves, and spin waves are gapless excitations. In this case, since the ground state is not nil ordered, it has these critical correlations, we don't have exactly spin waves. And it turns out that what we have are so-called spin-ons. So if we think of a spin wave, it's something which has spin one, the ground state. We can think of, we can think of the spin wave as carrying spin one. In this case, the excitations, if we imagine an experiment, for example, we let, for example, neutron scattering, a neutron can come in and interact with the spin system, and it can also excite with spin one. So it can change the spin in units of one. But it turns out that the elementary excitations of the spin chain are not spin waves. You can think of them as two spin one-half objects that are almost independent of each other. So when you excite a spin one, in fact, you excite two spin-ons at the same time. So that's an interesting aspect of this, and we, yeah.
Are those like the domain wall particles?
Right. So that's right. So they correspond to domain walls. Of course, if you think about a nil state, you can easily make domain walls. Now, of course, the ground state is not really a nil state. But still the picture, if you just draw an icing, maybe I can do it here on the board. Maybe you have seen this before in the course. So if you just imagine that the ground state is the nil state. And now locally we flip a spin. So we flip that spin. I just put a marker here to denote that that's where we did something. So now you see we get two bonds that are not happy here, right? These bonds are all happy. They are anti-parallel. These are parallel. Now what can happen is that, okay, this costs some energy. If we think of in terms of the Ising model, these cost just potential energy. But now since we have already flipped the spin, it doesn't cost any more energy to flip spins neighboring or spins at these defects. So we can, for example, flip that one down, and now this defect moved here, and we can just continue. So these are now domain walls. As we continue to move this out, we form another antiferromagnetic domain there, which is just shifted by one. And so indeed, the excitations, the spin-ons, correspond to these domain walls. But one has to be a little bit careful because the background we are looking at, the ground state, does not have nil order. But it turns out that there are still, it still has these topological properties which allows one to think of it in terms of domain walls. So did you discuss this in some other course?
Dr. Reitner's
house. Oh, okay. Right. But he talked about classical domain walls,
yes.
Probably. Right. Yeah, so this is the analog of that. So sometimes people call them solitons as well. Okay, now so what happens if we turn up this coupling even more? So then something interesting happens. So what happens is that the form of the spin correlation changes completely. Instead you get this exponentially decaying correlation. And if you go to infinite system size, you actually get two degenerate ground states with this kind of cartoon picture. Again, this means singlets, so the spins pair up in singlets, and you can do that in two different ways. So what happens in a finite system is that if you look at, if you were able to compute all the energies, all the eigenstates, or just the energies of the system, you would see that you have two closely spaced states, and then you have all the other states, and there's a gap between these. And as the system size goes to infinity, these also go together, so they become a completely degenerate. So these two states are the symmetric and anti-symmetric combination of these two. Of course, these states, this is again the symmetry breaking issue, right? These two states break translational symmetry, which the Hamiltonian does not do. The Hamiltonian has translational symmetry. So all the eigenstates must also be translationally invariant. And we can construct such states as the antisymmetric and symmetric combination of these, and they will correspond to these two states. When we go to the infinite system size, well, and I should say, of course, any linear combination of those states is also an eigenstate, well, in the thermodynamic limit, right? So when this gap vanishes here, any linear combination will be an eigenstate, and then we can, for example, prepare the system in this configuration, and it will always stay there, because in a very similar way to what we discussed with these other symmetry breaking issues, it would take an infinitely long time to actually get to that state. So, well, okay, I should say that there's an interesting thing here. If you put G exactly equal to 1/2, these are even exact ground states for any finite system with an even number of sites. And that solution is one of those exact results, which in the end are very easy. So I will actually do this calculation for you later when we talk about valence bonds and the valence bond basis in more detail. We will actually prove that these are eigenstates of this Hamiltonian when J 2 over J 1 is 1/2. So anyway, the point was there's a phase transition here, and the phase transition is between a kind of critical phase and a dimerized or valence bond solid phase. All right. Now let's look at frustration in higher dimensions. So that was a well-studied example of frustration in 1D, and I could mention just to as an example of the fact that what is definitely true in quantum magnetism is that there are some models that are quite old. I mean, they were initially studied many years ago. So, for example, this Mashumdar-Ghosh is named after Mashumdar and Ghosh, who did a paper on this in 1963 or something like that. But still, to this date, people don't understand very well the full phase diagram of this model. So actually, if I make G really large, you get even some other phases that are still, I mean, there was a paper on this just a couple of months ago. Some people numerically had been able to push this to higher G and had some new insights and so on. So many of these old models are really quite challenging and complicated still. So people look at them and get new insights all the time. Now, frustration in higher dimensions, this is also in principle an old topic, but a really modern topic as well. So let's first look at the case of geometrical frustration, where we think of just having nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic interactions, but the lattice is such that wow, that was an interesting typo there. That we cannot minimize all classical bond energies at the same time. So in the case of the Nell state, these 2D square lattice, for example, that we have talked about, if you think of the classical model, it's completely clear what the ground state spin configuration is, because you can have the minimum energy for each bond simultaneously. If you take something like a triangular lattice and put spins there, you will see that it's not possible to minimize all bond energies simultaneously. So this is maybe the simplest case of a geometrically frustrated lattice. A very interesting system is this Kagome lattice. And Kagome, by the way, you may know, is it's not Kagome, some French name. It's actually a Japanese basket style, right, which has this kind of pattern of weavings. So that's also highly frustrated. And this is another case. Well, this is actually the lattice in a specific material, but it's topologically equivalent to what's called the Shastri-Sutherland lattice, where you just deform this a little bit. So this was studied by Shastri and Sutherland, the Heisenberg antiferromagnet on this kind of system. And that was also studied quite a long time ago, and later people found that there are actually materials which realize that kind of lattice. Well, in three dimensions, there's the pyrochlore lattice, so the Kagome lattice is, you see, it has corner-sharing triangles. This has corner-sharing tetrahedra, so the Kagome is the 2D version of pyrochlore, if you will, and this is another of the systems that people are really interested in, because there are many materials where you have some spins on these vertices here, and you would like to understand the nature of the spin system on such lattices. So let's just look. I'm sure you have seen this before. If you look, just talk about frustration in the simplest context, it would be a single triangular cell. So if we have an Ising model, you see that we cannot, let's say this is antiferromagnetic, so we would like to have these antiparallel edges, but there's always one parallel one, and there are six configurations that minimize the energy, so it's sixfold degenerate. If we go to vector spins, this kind of configuration minimizes the energy where the angle is 120 degrees between those spins. So the question is, what happens if we go to an infinite lattice, for example, the triangular lattice? So it turns out, in the case of the Ising model, as you increase the number of spins, the degeneracy grows very fast, and in fact, there's no order at zero temperature in the triangular Ising model. And the ground state is hugely degenerate. If you do vector spins, it turns out that this is the lowest energy configuration. We repeat this on all the triangles. So that's also referred to as three sublattice Nell order, because you have three directions of the spins corresponding to three, what we can call three sublattices. Now, what happens with quantum spins? So this was all classical. Now, how about, for example, a spin 1/2 quantum triangular Heisenberg model? This has also been a very controversial topic, a lot of different studies, and again, even if people have worked on it for a long time, it's still so challenging that people are still getting new results and insights. So there's this paper by White and Chernyshev from 2007, where I think they show in the most convincing way so far that this kind of order, in fact, does survive. So if you do just something like spin wave theory, you will find, so in spin wave theory, of course, you start from the classical states, you would start from that kind of state, then you add those bosons as we did, and you would find that the order survives. But one can question whether it's really correct, so people have tried to do any kind of model you can imagine, and this is probably the most convincing demonstration so far that even in the quantum case, that kind of order actually survives. But in other cases, for example, the Kagome system in two dimensions is probably the one that people are most interested in. So there it's actually very controversial what happens on the Kagome lattice. So the candidates are basically a kind of valence bond solid or a spin liquid. So the valence bond solid we looked at before, where you have a higher singlet probability in some simple fashion, like in columns or something like that. In this case, the candidate has some quite complicated pattern with 36 sites in the unit cell and so on. But still, it's not quite clear what's going on. I think I can do one more thing today. So those were cases where we imagine that the frustration is just by geometry. We have a lattice where all the interactions are antiferromagnetic and we cannot, and they compete with each other in some sense. We can also start with just the square lattice and include some longer range antiferromagnetic interactions, and then again you get frustration. So here the prototypical example is the J1, J2 Heisenberg model. And now you already are very familiar with my use of red and blue. So these are the two different couplings. And this is formally the Hamiltonian. So we have two couplings, J1 and J2. And again, I will refer to the ratio as G. Now here, the ground states are well understood, both in the limit of small g and large g. So OK, small g. That's just the standard Nell state, because if J2 is zero, we get back to our nearest neighbor case. So when we put a small J2, we don't expect things to change immediately. So we have Nell order, and it appears many calculations agree that at least up to something like G equals 0.042 or 0.43, I wrote 0.45 here, but something like that, we have Nell order. That's quite non-controversial. Also, if G is very large, it's quite clear what we have. So if J1 is zero, you see that we get two completely independent lattices of these blue. So you get two square lattices that are independent of each other when J1 is zero. So then you know that, okay, then we just have the Nell state on those independent lattices. Now, if you imagine that you very weakly couple those systems, they will orient each other, it turns out, in a striped fashion like this. So if you look at, For example, the way I draw point here, we have nil order on those J2 couple spins in both cases. And then when we couple them, the nearest neighbor interactions are happy in one direction but not happy in the other direction, and that's the compromise which, it turns out, minimizes the energy. And of course, this, if we get this kind of stripe pattern, we also break a four-fold symmetry, because these stripes could form in horizontally or vertically, and also we can shift them back and forth. Now, what's still, again, quite controversial is what happens between these two. So everybody agrees that there is some non-magnetic phase there, but what kind of phase is it? So here I drew it as a columnar valence bond solid, which is one of the stronger candidates, I think, for what we have here. So again, what it means is that if you think of singlets, you have a higher probability of singlet here than here and here. So again, this breaks, if we really get this kind of order, it breaks a symmetry of the Hamiltonian, because this state breaks translational invariance. So this is supposedly existing somewhere here, but it could also be something else. So it's not quite clear that if it is a valence bond solid, it could be another kind of valence bond solid, which we will discuss more later. It's sometimes referred to as a plaquette state, where instead of bonds, it's like you get higher correlations in plaquettes, in 2x2 plaquettes. But some people also propose that it's actually an example of this RVB spin liquid. So this is also controversial. Now, so these two-dimensional frustrated models are really challenging. And why is that? Well, it's really because there are no generically applicable unbiased methods. So no matter what you do, you have to make some approximations. And then it's not clear. The approximation may favor one kind of state over the other, and you cannot be completely sure. So that's why this state is so controversial, because different calculations give really completely different results, ranging from spin liquid to valence bond solid. So those are among the models where we cannot do that much, even computationally. One can do exact diagonalization, and we will do that. But these quantum Monte Carlo methods that I have referred to and which we will use, those are really not of much use in these systems. All right, so I think that's where I will stop today, and tomorrow I will continue a little bit on a couple of other examples of models and their phases and possible phase transitions. So, do you have any questions? All right, so let's continue tomorrow then.